Live from New York City, it's the Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null, broadcasting and video streaming live from our studios in New York City. And I welcome you. Today, we're going to talk about traditional Asian diets, lowering insulin resistance, especially in Asian Americans. Also, how epigenetic memory, that which is at the very beginning of our life, even when we're developing as a fetus, can be passed across generations and from cell to cell during development. We're also going to talk about spinach and what it can do to reduce appetite and food cravings. And a classroom on the air today. Good information from Michael Downey, Life Extension. We're going to talk about how green tea, something I discuss almost every day, protects against Alzheimer's disease. So you're going to get the latest on that, which is going to help a lot of people because we have a lot of people in this audience whose family members suffer from Alzheimer's. We're also going to do a original in-depth investigative report today. It is called Food Fascists, GMOs, and Pesticide Manufacturers Down and Dirty. Richard Gale and myself have taken almost a half a year of research and scholarship to produce this. And why at this time is this important? Because around the United States, based upon people becoming more conscious of the food choices they're making, global warming, destruction of soil, the acidification of our oceans and lakes, the dead zones in the Mississippi and 400 places around the world. The one at the Mississippi, at the mouth of the Mississippi, is the size of New Jersey. It's dead from nitrogen fertilizers in the Mississippi and other rivers. Nothing can live in it. And why buying local organic is good. So that's the reason. But also, we have a lot of listeners right now in the state of Colorado. And just a few weeks, they're going to be voting whether or not they should label genetically engineered materials in the state. But also, some communities want to ban all GMO foods. So there are some referendums. Now, on the one hand, the documentary, the multi-award-winning documentary, Seeds of Death, about GMOs, has been playing regularly on PBS Channel 12 Denver. In fact, I was sent a text yesterday from the program director who said, Gary, there's a huge debate going on out on the Facebook about your film. And I looked at it. The good news is at least 90% of the comments were positive to label GMOs, and the rest look like apologists or people unaware of the issue. So today, what you don't know about GMOs could hurt you and future generations. We'll show you the truth of the bad science, what GMOs do. In the second part of our program, we have a unique guest. And I'm going to give more time today to this guest than I normally would. He is Professor Graham McQueen from Hamilton, Ontario. He is professor of comparative religion at McMaster's University in Toronto for the past 30 years. But we're going to take a backwards look at the 2001 anthrax scare case. And that is important because we were led to believe one thing, his research shows another. He's a graduate from Harvard University with a PhD. He has authored many books, and we're going to explore this, so you will find this interesting. I suggest you let anyone who wants to hear this know that in about 25 minutes, they're going to hear about a false flag operation involving our government. Let's begin. When you travel throughout the Orient, and Malaysia as well, you'll find foods you do not find in the United States anywhere. Fruits and vegetables and tubers, and you'll find them seasoned with seasons you didn't know existed, and sometimes a little spicy for the average American palate. But they have a long tradition of using food as a medicine because most people are poor and cannot afford to go to a doctor, so therefore they know what to do for different conditions. When you come to the United States, however, you give up, more often than not, the traditional Asian diet, and you start accommodating an American diet. Fast foods, French fries, hamburgers, hot dogs, pizzas, colas, ice cream. And you start seeing the same diseases in the Asian American population as you do in the American population. Now, this is true of other cultures as well, and we've documented this on this program. This is from the Joslin Diabetes Center. It says, why are Asian Americans at higher risk of developing type 2 diabetes than Caucasian Americans and prone to develop the disease at lower body weights? One part of this puzzle may lie in the transition from traditional high-fiber, low-fat Asian diets to current westernized diets, which may pose extra risks for those of Asian heritage. That's according to Dr. George King and on this particular study. They gave a randomized clinical trial and found that what a person ate made an enormous difference. So here is, this was a 16-week trial, and here is the problem. When you start eating a high-fat, high-carbohydrate, high-sugar, and high-protein diet, you're going to end up with diabetes and other conditions at a higher rate. And when one of the first things you notice when you travel to the countryside or to a lot of foreign places, you find people are not starving. They're just thin. They're physically more active. They walk more. They bike more. They don't sit down and have three large meals a day in front of a television. And they tend to graze. They eat throughout the day, small quantities. But almost always they eat very high fibrous foods, low in fat. That was the outtake of this this study. I remember the first time I heard the notion of epigenetics, E-P-I-G-E-N-E-T-I-C, epigenetics. It was from Professor Bruce Lipton. He was a Stanford molecular biologist doing research there, and he found out that when he altered the gene of a cell, the cell could still function, and boy, did that throw him for a loop. That would be equivalent to you taking the engine out of a car, putting it in the garage, and yet the car drives down the street. Well, how's that possible? It doesn't have an engine in it. It's like you taking your brain out of your skull and disconnecting it and putting it in a refrigerator, and yet you're walking around thinking, how's that even possible? So that's what he was faced with. Since that time, we have an entire field of science called epigenetics. This is the latest on this from University of California, Santa Cruz. Quote, researchers traced markers of gene repression through cell divisions and showed that both sperm and eggs transmit a memory of gene repression to embryos. A growing body of evidence suggests that environmental stressors can cause changes in gene expression that are transmitted from parents to their offspring, making epigenetics a hot topic. Epigenetic modifications do not affect the DNA sequence of genes, but change how the DNA is packaged and how genes are expressed. Now, a study by scientists at the University of California, Santa Cruz shows how epigenetic memory can be passed across generations from cell to cell during development. The study, published in Science magazine, focused on one well-studied epigenetic modification, the methylation of DNA packaging protein. Anyhow, it's very scientific from here on out, so I won't go into it, but here's the takeaway message and why this is so important for us. Let's just say, and I'll make it really basic, let's say that you wanted a baby, you were looking forward to having a family, as many people do. It was a planned pregnancy, and now you're a pregnant mother, and you're so happy to be in this blissful state. So each day you sing, you massage your belly, you try to feel anything developing, you hum, you think positive thoughts. You're sharing unconditional love with that developing fetus. Now to the pragmatist, to the reductionist, to the Descartes mind person, it means nothing. There is no connection. Let's say that your husband suddenly has cold feet and doesn't want to. We're too young to have this pregnancy. We can't afford it. Abort it. It's the best thing to do. Or another person, hey, I didn't want this pregnancy. I'm not ready to get married and settle down. I'm out of here. Abandonment. Now, the average scientist historically would say that has nothing in the world to do with the outcome of that pregnancy. That the only thing that matters is what you're feeding your body and how that becomes the nourishment for the developing fetus. And then when the child is born, it doesn't matter whether you breastfeed him or you formula feed him. You're getting basic nutrients. One is not better than the other. And it doesn't matter whether you hire a nanny or you stay at home. It doesn't matter whether you send them to a private school, public school, or home school. They're all the same. As long as they're getting education, it's all the same. And so it goes. This is the reductionist mindset at work. And it is lethal. It is barbaric. Now what we know and what civilized minds have known throughout the millennia is that every thought you have, every expression that you engage in will have a vibration associated with it. In other words, there's an energy that you're producing. If you walk into a room and smile with people, suddenly there's a difference than if you walk in and grumble at people. If you touch a person lightly or if you touch them harshly, there's an outcome. And it's not just a moment that the physical contact, but it lasts in the expression of the memory in the genes. And now that's there forever. So now what we know through epigenetics is everything that was thought, said, experienced, eaten, drank, all end up being an energy that is shared with the DNA, including the developing fetus. So, in the case of the young woman whose father was a professor and very caught up in his studying and his science and his philosophy and didn't have time for a daughter, didn't even want a daughter, was not physically abusive, but certainly was at times verbally insensitive, she got the message at the epigenetic DNA level, and it turned her DNA in an off position. Now, that didn't mean that she stopped growing as a developing person. She grew. From the outside, you couldn't tell there was any damage. But at the cellular level, there was lots of damage. Now we know you can turn on and off. You can turn energy in the DNA on and hence help the healing of the body. And you can turn the DNA off in how it expresses an energy and produce disease. Depression, rage, insecurity, uncertainty, panic, anxiety, off, disease. Optimism, hope, compassion, creativity, joy, constructive challenges, on, healing, wellness. And this can be passed on from cell to cell, from generation to generation. That's how it works. So you are what you think. You are what you believe. You are what you express. Your cells are that, and you pass it on to the offspring. So now that professor's daughter grows up, and she's now a mature 20-year-old, and she's cynical about men. She doesn't see them as unconditionally loving because the DNA and the expression of the energy from her father was, men are not unconditionally loving. And so that DNA stays off. Imagine the outcome of all of her relationships. They'll all be self-sabotaged. And therefore what she feared, she ends up manifesting. You draw into your life that which you have expressed at the DNA level. Now, on the other hand, there could be a woman like Angelina Jolie who's told you have the genes, the DNA, that could produce cancer in the future, so get your completely healthy breast removed. If you're a happy, wholesome woman, you'll say, hold on a second. I may have a gene that may show some percentage of expression of cancer, breast cancer, but I've also done the following. I'm running every day and healthy. I'm happy. I'm singing. I have loving relationships and family. I am eating well. I'm not eating foods that contribute to DNA destruction. Therefore, there is zero chance that I'll end up with breast cancer. And therefore, I'm going to save my breast. Or, well, you know, I'm insecure. I'm not empowered. I trust authority figures rather than myself or common sense or reason. I'm not mindful of the choices I make. I'm reactive to the choices I make. So if you hit the right button, you'll get me to react. So if you mention fear, death, cancer, and inevitability, then you're mine. You know, I'm going to take your advice completely. If it means cutting off my breast, I'll cut out my breast. Even if they're totally healthy today. Because I don't trust myself. I believe that everything is inevitable. And if you're telling me that, well, sooner or later, that breast cancer gene is going to express itself as cancer, I'm not going to doubt you. Two different women. One would say, never. I'll control the outcome of any DNA expression by the choices I make. I'm mindful. I'm in the moment. I'm using reason. The other is, I'm a highly conditioned person that's never received unconditional love. I didn't know really the mother and father that born me because they were too busy in their careers. They weren't abusive physically, but they were neglectful when it came to love. So I thought that the love of a nanny was true love, but it wasn't. It was authoritarian. It was cold. It was pragmatic. So today, I'm not a whole human being. Because I have not been able to experience that which other people have. I was never breastfed because my mother didn't want to go through the inconvenience, but I was given a formula. Now I have all these allergies. The one woman said that she wouldn't vaccinate her children because there was no good science showing it was safe, and there was a lot showing that it was harmful. My mother would never question the doctor, so I was given all these vaccines. Now I have inner infections. I have all these other tics. And now all the kids in my school, They're taking drugs, and I'm taking one too because I've got ADHD. And the other one says, I don't have anything because my mother and father showed me that human beings can make mistakes, and mistakes don't define who you are as a mistake. They're only a learning lesson. So when I make a mistake, I learn the lesson of it. The other one says, when I make a mistake, that's as far as I can grow. I'm stigmatized by my mistakes, both me through self-doubt and low self-esteem, and others questioning whether I am worthy of their time and attention because I haven't succeeded. I haven't been the soccer mom's daughter that walks off the field with the award. Two different women, same age, completely different outcomes because of the epigenetics of the cell. The epigenetics of the parents become the epigenetics of the children, and unless you understand all this, you won't know what's been working against you in the subconscious since you were a kid. Spinach extract can naturally reduce appetite and food cravings. This is a good study. In this study at Lund University in Sweden, they took a group of overweight women for 3 months, and they had them drink a drink, a relatively small amount, 5 grams. That's a very small amount. That's like a quarter of a teaspoon of spinach extract every morning before breakfast, or they gave them a placebo drink. And then the women were told to eat 3 balanced meals a day, but were not told them what to eat. And as a result, those that had the spinach extract ate less. They didn't feel hunger at the same rate. So they even had a calming effect. Now we know that there are good greens like spinach, celery, and broccoli. You can eat a lot of them, but they have tiny amounts of calories, but they fill you up with a lot of fiber, which is good, and turn off your appetite. So that's one good study. So they did this study with spinach, but they could have done it with any one of 100 vegetables and come up with the same outcome. The more vegetables you eat, the less appetite you have, the less you're likely to gorge on that big steak or a bunch of fries, because it fills you up, the fiber expands, it holds water, cleanses your intestine, all good. Finally, a study shows that gamma tocotrienols slows down high-fat diet-induced obesity, improves insulin resistance. This is from Florida, University of Florida. And most people are not aware of even what the tocotrienols, toco, T-O-C-O, tri, T-R-I-E, enols, E-N-O-L. These are fractions of vitamin E. So I like to buy them separately. I like to buy natural vitamin E, 400 units twice a day, and tocotrienols, 200 units, twice a day. By taking the tocotrienols and the tocopherols from vitamin E, you're getting an improvement in your blood. It's anti-inflammatory. It can turn on inflammation. It helps you maintain better insulin levels. It helps control oxygenation in your cells, which you want. You want that oxygen in the blood. You want that oxygen in the cells. And it gives it to you. All good. And it works. That's our latest on health and healing. We're going to take a brief break and come back. Please stay with us. I'd like to welcome all of you from all over the world. We have people listening. We have tens of thousands from Great Britain, from India, a large audience in India. We thank you all from 167 countries, plus around the United States. In about 10 minutes now, we're going to hear about the anthrax scandal that went on back in 2001. And that helped give us all of the Patriot Act and the Homeland Security system, how we became a police state. But there's a part of that story the public has not known. Oh, and by the way, you know, those very conscientious, those brave, those noble partners in our expedition in the Middle East, you know, bombing ISIS. Why don't we know the full story about them? Well, let's take a look at Saudi Arabia. I'm only going to take one today. Transparency International investigation found that Saudi Arabia is the world's largest arms importer with the least safeguards against the corruption in the defense industry, with the highest corruption risk. Radical Islam, under the form of Wahhabism, is the religion of Saudi royals, the state bureaucracy, the army and the air force, and of course Osama bin Laden, and the militant wing of political Islam, represented by ISIS and Al-Qaeda. Shiite Muslims make up 15% of Saudi's population, but are deprived of the most basic rudiments of normal life. They are oppressed, much like the Sunni are oppressed in Iraq. Human rights violations and crimes have increased in recent years as there is greater public dissent against the royal Saud family. There have been thousands of unfair trials and arbitrary detentions in recent years. There are 9 million foreign workers in Saudi Arabia who are denied basic rights, and many from undeveloped nations in Asia that live on virtually no human conditions. public executions by beheading with the sword or stoning or firing squad, followed with crucifixion, can be for robbery, drug use, or beliefs opposing Islam, a rape. So on the one hand, we all are rightly outraged by beheadings by ISIS. Why has there not been a word of the beheadings by Saudi Arabia, which are 10 times more beheadings by Saudi Arabia? Discrimination against women is epidemic. It has been called the gender apartheid. 70% of university students are women. 82% of women are literate, but only 5% are allowed to work in the workplace, even after advanced educations. For a woman to enter a hotel requires a national ID card, room reservation, and stay is immediately reported to local police for any hotel by any woman under any condition in Saudi Arabia. It's the only country in the world where women are forbidden to drive cars. There's no religious freedom in Saudi Arabia, and public practice of non-Islamic traditions are prohibited. The nation has a specific department of religious police. If the police are driving down the street and if they see an ankle, if they see a wrist, they'll get out and just beat the hell out of you. You have no rights whatsoever under any conditions in Saudi Arabia if you're a woman. You will have less rights than a dog. This is our partner. They are criminals. The entire royal family are criminals. They're terrorists. They support terrorism. They have been funding terrorists nonstop. They're funding ISIS, training ISIS. Yet they're now going to help us fight ISIS. Yeah. In 2009, the anti-witchcraft unit of the National Police Force was created. Most cases were just built on fraud charges because they had to justify it. In recent years, individuals, usually non-Saudi workers, who have been caught with anything representing a challenge have been executed. Last year, 600 people were accused of witchcraft in Saudi Arabia. If you just wore a little tiny protective amulet, similar like a Christian wearing a cross or the image of the Virgin Mary around the neck, which is common throughout the non-Islamic world, then that's considered witchcraft. If you're gay, you're going to be punished, lashed, executed. All press and media censored. All internet blogging that criticize the regime or the Wahhabi cult is punishable by imprisonment. All sexual suggestions by Saudi nationals or workers in the country found on the internet is subject to prison time. All political parties are banned. All. So, even the Green Party of Saudi Arabia is an illegal organization. It is corrupt and fraudulent at every level. And we have a Saudi prince that defected and told us a lot that we didn't know. Tomorrow I'll talk about Prince Khalid bin Farhan Al Saud. He's announced his defection from Al Saud royal family through a statement calling on other princes to break their silence and reveal the truth. That you will find interesting, and that will be on tomorrow's program. So much for the people that we say are fighting terrorism. They are the major cause of terrorism, promoting in terrorism. But don't ask the major media to tell you that. You won't get that on Al Jazeera. You won't get it anywhere else. You will get it here. Now, I'm going to hold my food fascist report till tomorrow because it's about 15 minutes. And we're going to give you a little bit more on green tea. Then we're going to take our break. We're going to come back with our guest. But I want you to know that why green tea is so important and why we should have it. The latest research shows that it can stop a lot of the buildup of the toxic protein fragments called amyloid beta. And green tea gets to the root of the Alzheimer's disease by three distinctive mechanisms. By preventing the formation of amyloid plaques, that's good. Breaking down existing plaques, that's great. And creating critical new neurons in the brain, that's terrific. So as a result, green tea consumption has now been associated with a 54% reduction in the risk of developing cognitive decline. And that's what we need. And now they're using neuroimaging scanning for the first time in the human clinical setting to demonstrate that green tea boosts activity in an area of the brain specifically used for working memory. And Alzheimer's disease, by the way, is the sixth leading cause of death in America and the fifth leading cause of death in those over 65. Amazing. One in three seniors dies with Alzheimer's or another form of dementia. So we need green tea. So let's review very quickly. First, it prevents formation of amyloid plaques that are characteristic, these little fat streaks in the brain. Then it breaks down the existing amyloid plaques by disrupting early stage and late stage aggregation processes. And lastly, it promotes the production of new neurons, what is called neurogenesis, in the adult hippocampus. That's the area of the brain responsible for converting memories from short-term to long-term. And green tea contains what are called catechins, which are naturally occurring multifunctional compounds that have been found to have potent neuroprotective effects. Specifically, the powerful green tea catechin EGCG has been found to lessen cognitive impairments induced by psychological stress, and so it can help you with stress. So green tea, I'm suggesting 200 to 1,000 milligrams a day, or maybe two cups a day. And you can put some flavored stevia in it. You can put some mint leaves in it. That's a nice way to get it. You can put a teaspoon of Manuka honey in it. You can chill it, make it as an iced tea. You can add some lemon to it, make it as a lemon green tea, iced tea. So no shortage of ways of using it, but get it in. It protects your brain. In 5 minutes, we're going to our guest. Right now, I've got a special for you. And that special, I've got two specials. In my career, I look forward to what I call the remarkable moments. For example, when I was on PBS and 1998 with a new special. They'd never aired one on aging, and it was the biggest hit in the history of PBS by an individual. I'd broke every record on every PBS station in America. And I was out on the road constantly, you know, talking about anti-aging then, and then a lot of others followed. I currently have a very popular one on called Reboot Your Brain, Reversing Brain Aging Naturally, but this is over 15 years after the first one. And that's one of those remarkable moments. You do something, it's like doing something you'll never do again, but you did it. And I remember the first green stuff I created. I look at all the different things in my life, creating the Progressive Radio Network, which now we're approaching 3 million people coming to our site per day. You know, we will get in the very near future 100 million visits per month. That's serious traffic. And I just brought in a company today to start doing major social media to get the word out of all of our 80 hosts. Those are remarkable moments. But recently, just 2 days ago, I had another remarkable moment. I want to share this with you. It started several years ago when I was researching the medicinal value of grapes. Because I'm asking, should people take resveratrol by itself? Which is the big thing because people have patents on it and are marketing it. But in my opinion, why take it by itself? Because it's naturally a part of the grape. Should people eat grapes or should people have grape juice? And the more research I did, the more study I did, I began to realize that we have something that we can do that's unique, but we're not doing it. Hasn't been done. So first I collected all the scientific literature I could find on grapes. And then resveratrol, grape seed, grape skin. And I started working on a formula. It would be similar in how it's made. Raw, all natural, wholesome, non-GMO, and vegan. Low calorie, good for diabetics and people with insulin problems. But it would have everything that's in the whole grape. Batch after batch after batch, month after month, over a year and a half, till we finally got it perfect. But I added some more things. I started realizing, if the apple is so darn good, why don't we put apple in here too? So I put the apple fiber in. And then flaxseed is so good, I put the flaxseed in. And the OFS, the probiotics. And then oats, one of nature's most perfect grains, if not the most perfect grain. And then finally, vitamin C. So I put grape seed extract, grape skin extract, the whole grape, resveratrol, apple fiber, flaxseed, FOS, oats, and ascorbic acid, cranberry, beet, stevia, and the natural grape flavor. Well, the remarkable moment came when yesterday in the afternoon, the first jars arrived. Small batch, only 400. And we put it around the office, and everyone just said, this is phenomenal. And Jeremy, who is here, just walked in the office. He wanted to see what he could find on grape. What'd you find, Jeremy?
Yeah, good afternoon, Gary. So I did a quick search this morning to just take a look at the scientific literature over the last 18 months or so into grape skin extract, grape seed extract, resveratrol, and the ingredients. And are you aware, in just the last 18 months alone, the amount of studies that have come out to really show the grape, how it can be elevated to the level of a superfood, and all the benefits, all the beneficial compounds that can be found in the grape. I mean, it's absolutely remarkable.
I wasn't aware how many studies are there?
I mean, hundreds. And we're just talking recently, in the last few years. Hundreds.
It's the superfood of the future.
Absolutely.
And don't tell people what it does.
All right.
I never make a claim, all right? Because I see that you have all these studies here.
Right.
From peer-reviewed literature. People can do their own homework. It's easy enough. You know, they can just Google resveratrol. They can Google apple fiber. They can Google flaxseed. They can Google grape seed extract and grape skin extract and whole grape. And it's all there for them. I believe that this will be more important than green stuff or red stuff. Mm-hmm. Those are both important.
Yes.
And you need those. I take them every day. But now I'm adding in. I did this morning. I put my green stuff, greens and grains, red stuff, berry blast, supremacy, heavenly aloe, muscle stuff, and then first time ever, mm-hmm. I put my grape stuff in there, and mm-hmm. it tastes like grapes.
Oh, it's delicious.
It's delicious.
It is absolutely delicious.
Well, what we have the big jar now, grape stuff, brand new. It's my most important, it's one of those ooh-ha moments. Wow. You know, it's a remarkable moment. I'm so excited that it's finally done. Because when you work, you know how many batches we sent around the office. You know how much research we were doing. Mm-hmm. It's now done. It's finished. It's there. Mm-hmm. It's like a movie. You see how much time we're putting upstairs in edit, working on Poverty Inc. to get it ready for the Academy Award submission.
Yes.
We've got 2 weeks to get it ready and submit it. Mm-hmm. But we're there. Mm-hmm. All those long weeks and months on the road filming, staying in cheap hotels at night, you know, and driving 8 hours a day to get to someone to film for a half hour. It's done. It's over. Don't have to do it again. It's like pregnancy. I don't have to go through birthing pains, delivery pains again. It's done. So we have today what I consider one of the single most powerful, nourishing, positive foods that you can put in your body. This is not a supplement. This is the whole food. This is raw, all natural, grape stuff. Tastes phenomenal. You're going to love this. And it will not take a backseat to green stuff, red stuff, greens and grains, or berry blast. It stands on its own. It is a super food. You can look for yourself at what it does. I make a medical claim or healing claim. If I did, I wouldn't have enough inventory to handle it. Here's what you get. The normal price is, what is it, Jeremy? $109.95.
Yep.
Okay. And we're offering it for what?
for $76.99.
That's an introductory. That's normally what our continuity price would be. Mm-hmm. So it's $76.95. That's it. We have about 200 left, and then it'll be about 6 weeks before we get more. But we're getting them out the door today. You order today, goes out today. All right? Call 877-627-5065. 877-627-5065. 877-627-5065. Or you can drop by our vitamin closet from noon till 7 p.m. 7 days a week and pick one up for yourself. You will start using this, and I want to get your feedback of how good it works for you. That's the... I was going to offer one other thing, but I think that's enough for today. We'll offer just today grape stuff. Mm-hmm. All right? Brand new. Newest invention. Years in the development and making. It's now there. There's nothing else like it. It's one of a kind. It's the first. All right? There'll be copiers. But I wonder where they're going to get their grapes. China? Right? No. People know that when they get our products, it's the highest integrity. I'll take whatever time it takes, whatever expense is necessary to make sure ours are as pure and as good as they can be. Grape stuff. Everyone should be having this every day. Athletes, twice a day. Grape stuff, 877-627-5065, and you're getting a phenomenal introductory offer. Back in a moment with my guest. Please stay with us. I'd like to welcome you from all over the world. I'm Gary Nall. Now we're going to Hamilton, Ontario, where comparative religion professor at McMaster's University in Ontario for the last 30 years, Professor Graham McQueen, holds forth. He's devoted his time to peace and justice activities, social activities, research into the anomalies around 9/11. He was an organizer for the 9/11 Toronto hearings and a co-editor of the peer-reviewed journal 9/11 Studies. Earlier, Professor Graham was the founding director of McMaster Center for Peace and Studies and helped create peace projects in war-torn regions such as Sri Lanka and Gaza, Croatia, and Afghanistan. He's contributed to the development of the Women's Peace Brigade in North India, and he's published numerous peer-review articles and book chapters, as well as several books. And he has a PhD from Harvard University and has numerous articles. And his most recent book is The 2001 Anthrax Deception, The Case for a Domestic Conspiracy, the most thorough analysis to date about the anthrax scare following the 9/11 bombings. His articles can be read at journalof911studies.com. Nice to have you with us today, Professor McQueen.
Thank you, Mr. Nall. I'm happy to be here.
In the aftermath of 9/11, there was immediately the anthrax scare. Envelopes of powder containing anthrax were being sent to elected officials and major media with notes pointing to Al-Qaeda terrorists. The large majority of Americans have now forgotten this incident, and many regard it simply as a strange anomaly without any direct relevance or association with the perpetrators of the 9/11 attacks. Nor do many people know the role the fear and terrorist use of bioweapons had in the creation of the Patriot Act and the Bush-Cheney administration's attempt to ram the act through Congress and the Senate. So please begin with reviewing the primary highlights of the anthrax scare in immediately after 9/11 and into October when the Patriot Act was signed into law, and how does it connect with the 9/11 attacks, if it does? And then briefly speak about why you believe Democratic Senators Daschle and Leahy were singled out to receive the anthrax letters.
Okay, I'll do my best. And please interrupt me, Gary, if I get off track, because I certainly will. Okay, so about a week after the 9/11 attacks, somebody put deadly spores of the bacterium anthrax into envelopes. They also put in little notes with text. They sealed them, and they sent them out. The first wave went to news organizations in the United States. Second wave went to Democratic senators in Congress. So for a while there in September, these letters were making their way through the mail. They were being opened here and there in the news agencies. Some people were getting cutaneous anthrax from that, but it's not easy to diagnose, so for the first while it went undiagnosed. The first person to be diagnosed with having the disease called anthrax was Robert Stevens, and he was diagnosed on October 3rd, 2001. This was announced publicly the following day, October 4th, and he died on October 5th, having gotten the very, very deadly form of anthrax called inhalation anthrax. That's when you breathe it in and it gets into your lungs. So basically, from the period when the letters were first sent, 17th or 18th of September, to this first diagnosis on October 3rd, letters were making their way through the mail, but nobody except the perpetrators were supposed to have known that anthrax was in play. Now, one of the first signs that something strange is going on is that, in fact, there were many articles in the newspaper, much reference on TV and so on, during this early period, to the possibility that the extremists who did the 9/11 attacks might be following up with biological or chemical attacks, so-called weapons of mass destruction, which was widely held to be even more dangerous and more scary than smashing airplanes into buildings. And, of course, it can be more dangerous. Depending on how it's done, it could kill a great many people. So we have an odd thing from the beginning, namely that when you study the record carefully, from our vantage point now, it's clear that there was widespread advance knowledge that these anthrax attacks were coming. And you have quite specific references in the newspapers about, well, you know, people could put them in letters and they could be sent out and, you know, people could get anthrax and we wouldn't even know about it for a while. It would take a while to diagnose it. In fact, the Washington Post had an article like that on September 17th saying, you know, I mean, if anthrax is being spread around, that would be really scary, but we wouldn't know about it for some time. It's on exactly that day, September 17th, or possibly the day after, that actual letters with spores are being put in the mail. And so you get all this strange foreknowledge. And, of course, the most famous part of this is that George W. Bush, the president, and his vice president, Dick Cheney, are both put on Cipro, the antibiotic, which was used to treat and to prevent anthrax. They were put on Cipro on September 11th, before there was any anthrax set out. And they weren't the only ones, but they were the main ones. And before there was any public knowledge of the anthrax, before there was any legitimate public knowledge, before Stevens' diagnosis, there was actually a run on Cipro. There was a big anthrax scare. The druggists were saying, we can't keep this antibiotic in stock. There's people calling for an anthrax vaccine. Now, at the time, this all seems to have been taken in stride by people. Oh, well, I guess the intelligence services that we have, the CIA and the FBI and so on and so forth, have gotten wind of the fact that somebody, probably Al-Qaeda, and then later in October the word Iraq begins to be mentioned, that these nasty enemies have got hold of anthrax. And so they're warning us. And the warnings result in precautions, and there's really nothing fishy about it. But standing now in 2014 and looking back on it, we can see that it's fishy in the extreme, because Al-Qaeda didn't have anthrax, and Iraq had destroyed its anthrax stores years before, in 1991. We now know that. It's actually impossible for me to believe that U.S. intelligence didn't know that. So, in that case, all this advanced knowledge stuff is fishy. It's like has to have come from the perpetrators themselves. Meanwhile, 5 people died of inhalation anthrax. Another 22, at the very least, were injured. Some people think the figure is actually over 450. And although the mortality here is obviously small compared to the 9/11 attacks, you have to remember this was, because this anthrax was weaponized, it was, that is to say, modified from its natural state to make it useful as a weapon. This means that a weapon of mass destruction, the greatly dreaded WMD, had actually been unleashed on the American population, both to kill unsuspecting civilians and potentially to kill members of Congress. So it seemed like classic terrorism. If the term terrorism means anything at all, it has to mean the conscious, deliberate spread of fear and terror among the civilian population for political ends. Well, that's exactly what this was. In fact, when you read the letters enclosed with the spores, you find things like, "Are you afraid?" A clear taunt. "Yeah. You die now. Take penicillin now," so on and so forth. And then they all end off with death to America, death to Israel. Allah is great. And they also have at the head of the letter the date 9/11. So what is that saying? It's saying we're the guys who did 9/11. We're extremist Muslims. We're crude. We can't write English properly. We want to kill you, we want to scare you, and so on and so forth. So the message is clearly, well, here we are again. This is the second punch, and the 1-2 punch started with 9/11. We're Al-Qaeda, we want to get you and kill you in your beds, and so on and so forth. This was the first hypothesis, and most Americans bought it. We know this because of a poll taken in mid-October. Then, also in mid-October, a second wrinkle is introduced, and Iraq begins to be blamed for this. And this leads to what I call the double perpetrator hypothesis, which begins to be boldly advanced by government officials in mid-October 2001. And the idea here is that Iraq has an anthrax program, which it somehow has hidden from the UN inspectors, and is producing sophisticated anthrax, which it then supplies to its proxies, namely Al-Qaeda. And Al-Qaeda provides the foot soldiers who actually puts the spores in the envelopes, writes the crude little letters, and sends it off. And this double perpetrator hypothesis serves many functions. First of all, it legitimates an armed attack on Afghanistan and Iraq. So in other words, foreign policy goals, which have already been formulated clearly at this point by the U.S. government, are greatly supported by this hypothesis, and they speed it up and they can help convince the American population this is the right way to go. And at the same time, that outward movement, that foreign policy goal is being achieved, there's an inward movement, and that is, you American citizens, says the executive branch of government, must be willing to surrender some of your civil rights because this is an emergency. The 9/11 attacks are now being followed up with a second wave. And therefore, we want you to all get behind us, and we want the legislative branch to get behind us. We want Congress to pass with blazing speed and without any hesitation the USA Patriot Act, which will restrict everybody's liberties. And we want the NSA to start massive spying on Americans. These all happened in October. These all happened at this time we're talking about here. So these much-forgotten anthrax attacks were crucial in helping to follow up the scare started by the 9/11 attacks, to keep up the momentum, to say, we're still scared, have to be scared. Congressmen should hide their congressional pins identifying who they are. They should take off their special license plates, put barricades around Congress. You're all in danger. That's why you have to pass this act as soon as possible. And then, of course, it's in that context that two of the leading Democratic senators who were in a position to slow down or stop the Patriot Act suddenly get sent anthrax letters with the crude written note and the extremely sophisticated and deadly anthrax spores. So that's the initial part of the story, and the only thing that I would say right now is that just after Mr. Bush signed the Patriot Act into law, which was October 26th, and he gave a little speech there explaining that this was all to save Americans from the people who did 9/11 and by the people whom he obviously considered the same people who did the anthrax attacks. Very soon after that event on October 26th, the anthrax story began to collapse and fall apart. And that's what distinguishes it from the 9/11 story, which has proven more resilient, even though it's been, in my opinion, taken apart piece by piece over the last 13 years. But nonetheless, it has somehow managed to stay up there. Anthrax story didn't have that resilience. And by the end of 2001, it was admitted by the White House, by the FBI, by Homeland Security, that this wasn't done by Iraq. This wasn't done by Al-Qaeda. It wasn't done by Muslims of any kind. This came from inside the U.S. military and intelligence communities. It came from a domestic, highly secure laboratory in the United States serving those communities. And that was a big shock. And ever since then, the FBI has been running around trying to comfort Americans, in a sense, by finding a perpetrator that would allow them to go to sleep at night. And what they did was, of course, find a lone wolf, or more specifically, a lone nut perpetrator working in a military lab that they could blame it on. And that's Bruce Ivins. And that's the official FBI story. Naturally, in my book, I criticize that story. I don't think Dr. Ivins had anything to do with this. It's a shame that he's dead, apparently by his own hand after the FBI harassment. It's a shame that his name has been blackened. It's a shame he never had a chance to go to court to meet these charges. But I think it's important for us to throw out that absurd FBI hypothesis and try and find out who really did it.
Okay, Dr. McQueen, could you please, in succinct manner, since we only have about 5 minutes left, would you please go through and just deconstruct very quickly? They can read the book for more detailed information.
Yeah.
Deconstruct the FBI. And before you do that, do you believe that there's any veracity that this was a false flag operation?
Well, I think it was clearly a false flag operation. In other words, a group of people pretended to be extremist Muslims connected to 9/11 and carried out deadly attacks in the United States. They pretended this so that they could help give juice to this global war on terror and legitimize invasions of countries and taking away American citizens' rights. I think that's clear. That's one of the main themes of the book.
Okay. Could you now deconstruct quickly the FBI and the National Security Agency's arguments?
Well, the FBI has constructed a circumstantial and, in my opinion, slanderous case against Bruce Ivins, its chosen lone nut perpetrator. You can actually read the full document in which they give their case. It's on the Internet. In my opinion, it's a very weak document. And over the past 3 years, the whole case has been falling apart. First of all, Bruce Ivins did not have the skill set to provide, to create this highly sophisticated process that was used in the letters to the senators. Dried anthrax, microencapsulated. In other words, it was coated with materials to make it more deadly, to make it an aerosol. He didn't have the skill set. He also didn't have the time and availability, which one of his bosses has pointed out in great detail. There's no way, he says, Bruce Ivins could have done that. In fact, he's generally been supported by his colleagues and by the scholarly community. And for a number of other reasons, the Ivans hypothesis doesn't work. But I would say the ultimate reason it doesn't work is because Ivans couldn't possibly have done all the things that were done. He couldn't have planted all the articles in the newspapers and created all the fake foreknowledge that happened. He couldn't have created a great plan as to how to get the Patriot Act through and how to justify invasions of two countries. It's absurd. It's clear that this was done by a group, and that the group included people in high-level positions in the executive branch of government.
Speak at the my final question for you is, during your investigation research, what have some of the most outrageous anomalies that you uncovered and appear to be the most suspicious reasons to suggest the anthrax threat came from very high levels you just mentioned in the U.S. government?
I think, really, you have to go through the detailed timeline that I give in the book. The way the anthrax attacks were used day by day to force Congress, essentially, to pass the Patriot Act. You see, what that shows is not just that this was a domestic operation, but that it was very high level and came from the executive branch, because you have all these guys, you know, Rumsfeld, Cheney, Bush, others of them also, coming out publicly and saying, you have to pass that Patriot Act within the next few days, because if you don't, there's going to be biological or chemical weapons used on us. Now, there's no way they could have known that. It's clear that there was a plot. I mean, that's why I use the term conspiracy in the title of my book. We shouldn't run away from that term. This was a conspiracy. And these guys were involved. Now, some of them may not have known what they were involved in. They may have been given the script by others. But ultimately, this plot was from very high level.
Finally, what do you know about the government training exercises of a simulated anthrax attack before 9/11?
Well, the most interesting, from my point of view, is Dark Winter, which is a bioweapons training exercise that happened in June of 2001 at Andrews Air Force Base, several months before the 9/11 attacks. And as I point out in the book, there's about 10 similarities between that and the actual anthrax attacks that soon follow. Many of the personnel are the same. People are, in one moment, they're doing a simulation. The next minute, they're involved in the actual anthrax attacks. You know, in the simulation, people's civil rights are being curtailed, and there's violence against Muslims in society. And perhaps most telling of all, in the simulation, it turns out that the attacks have been done by, quote, a group based in Afghanistan, and bin Laden is mentioned by name, supported by Iraq, which has supplied
wow.
them. Yeah, I mean, it's all laid out there.
And all before 9/11. How
yes,
about that?
Before 9/11, that's right.
That could not be a coincidence.
I don't think so.
Professor Graham Greene, you have contributed a major piece of scholarship, the 2001 Anthrax Deception, the Case for Domestic Conspiracy. You have an outstanding reputation, Ph.D. from Harvard, a 30-year tenured professor of comparative religion at McMaster's University, Ontario, dozens of papers in peer-reviewed journals. So you do not approach this lightly. You give us your insight. It is for us now to realize what you have given us and how to contemplate it and what action to be done. Thank you very much, sir, for being with us.
Thank you very much, Gary, for being willing to have me on your show.
Professor Graham McQueen, from Hamilton, Ontario. I'm Gary Nall. Thank you all for listening. Look forward to sharing more tomorrow. Let's say hello to Utrice Lee. Hi, Utrice.
Hello, Gary. Today we're talking about Russia, China, and the Islamic State, the triple challenge to U.S. foreign policy.
Excellent. Right now on Utrice Lee.
The Gary Null Show's executive producer is Richard Gale. Our program director is Jason Taubenfeld. The archive team is Sharon Pride and Casey Holford. And our head engineer is Giselle Hernandez. You can download past programs by visiting our archives at prn.fm.